I'm Shalina Tobin, aka Poshnosh Gal, and I'm so excited to be chatting with someone so young who's already got two restaurants to his name, Will Devlin. From his early years working with some of the biggest names in the industry, Will's realized his dream combination of doing what he loves, where he loves, in the heart of Kent. His philosophy of using homegrown produce in his countryside restaurants has been rewarded with many accolades, including Kent Chef of the Year and Chef to Watch by this year's Good Food Guide. Hi, Will. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing really well. I'm really excited about the openings this weekend.
Yes. Been waiting for it for a long time. You know, it's that kind of, well, I think every restaurateur have been wondering about sort of what's going to happen, what the guidelines are going to be, what we're allowed to do, what we're not allowed to do. And, you know, it's nice to have that clarity and something that we can, you know, we can work towards now and get ready to open.
Yeah. And how have things been for you during lockdown?
Yeah, tough, just like everyone. You know, during the lockdown wasn't so bad, because at least we had that control of, like, we weren't allowed to open the restaurant, but we could do an online service, which that's what we did. So we had something to focus on. But it was before the lockdown, I think, was the hardest time, kind of from back of February, early March onwards, when people started cancelling restaurant bookings. People were nervous about coming out. The government restriction, the government advice was to avoid restaurants and pubs, and that really hit us all super hard. That was tough. That was really tough to have, like, we had no control. And I think, not that we're control freaks, but chefs, restaurateurs, business owners in general, I think people, we like to know, like, we organize our ship and we make sure everything's in place and we control our reservations, our bookings, our menu, everything. And to all of a sudden have people just dropping left, right and center, it was scary. So I think we actually, the lockdown, furlough, business interruption loans and the government grants saved us. So yeah, it made it happen, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned you started selling online. What are the products you've been selling?
So loads of things. So we've obviously we've got the farm, so there's loads of produce coming out of the farm. So weekly veg boxes, people are subscribing to weekly veg boxes, which are great. Also hampers with some of our own charcuterie. We cure lots of meat. We've got a couple of cheese producers in our area, so like a cheese board, charcuterie, making loaves of bread, sending out with a bottle of wine, and our barbecue packs are going really, really well because the weather's been great. Again, you've been able to use some of our meat and vegetables and pickles and things like that, and get back in the kitchen kind of baking and making is good. So we do that on a Friday night and Saturday day, and we deliver to quite a few places in Kent. Actually, it started quite small and it grew quite quickly.
And do you think you're going to carry on with that once you open up?
It's going to be tough, but we're going to carry on offering it. I think we'll have to manage whether, like, if we can keep up with it to a decent standard. We've massively reduced, obviously, our opening. We've reduced our capacity, which therefore we've had a quite small team anyway, and we were looking to expand our team, so we kept our team quite small, especially for kind of social distancing during the working environment. It's kind of keeping it safe. So manpower and such, but I think, to be honest, the demand will probably start to reduce anyway, because people will be allowed to go out and go back to where they were eating before. But we'll definitely keep the veg box subscription. We've got a wine club that people have signed up to. So all of that stuff will just carry on and keep going.
Right. And have you managed to look after your livestock during the last few months? How's that part of the business
worked? Yeah, we've spent more time than ever with them, really. It's been hot. It's trying to keep the sheep cool and watered and stuff, and looking after the pigs and the chickens, etc. But we lambed a little bit later this year. So we started lambing towards like mid to end of April, and we had our last lamb about 2 weeks ago. We don't know, we've still got two ewes that we're unsure about, so that's been great. That normally we're doing that in between the restaurant and the farm and lambing, so it's some crazy sleepless nights. But this year's been quite cool, actually. It's been quite nice. I've been up there with my daughter and my wife and stuff. Right. It's been quite nice to have a bit of time off, actually.
Yeah, of course, because you're so busy in normal times. And it seems like, you know, we are coming out the other end of this, and you've really made things work for yourself in the meantime, and that's great. I'd love to hear more about your journey and how you began, as I'm sure our viewers would as well. So you actually started out life as a mechanic. How did you discover that you wanted to be in kitchens?
Yeah, I don't know. Mechanic was like... I'm massively dyslexic. I'm not very academic. So I kind of, in school, you were kind of pushed into university or go and get a trade, you know, get an apprenticeship, be a mechanic or a builder or plumber or something like that. And, you know, I don't think anyone knows what they want to be when they grow up, when you're 14, 15. Yeah. And I quite liked cars. So I played around with cars for a bit. And do you know what? I wasn't very good at it, and I didn't ever really like it. And I always cooked. And my mum was always saying to me, why are you like, she's like, I couldn't get it because I wouldn't go home and play with cars. I'd go home and like make bread and stuff. And she was just like, go, like, this isn't right. Like, are you sure you don't want to be a chef? And I was like, nah, like, it was never advertised to us when we were younger as a thing you could do. It was never taught as a subject in my school. It was never shown as a career path. So I never really thought about it. I just cooked a lot at home. And then, I was about 19 and I was a bit fed up, and I moved away to Ibiza for a summer and had a bit of a party, and then came back and I was a bit like, what am I going to do now? And it was my mum. She just said, listen, Will, I told you for years, go to... So I went to college and actually, started cooking at college, and everything I did was what they wanted. They were like, yeah, that's good, that's good. And I thought, actually, I'm good at something. Do you know what I mean? Like, I know how to do this stuff. So, and I think once you're in the industry and you start understanding kind of how big it is and how kind of immersive it is, I was just hooked. You know, I just loved it.
And I heard about this sort of life-changing moment for you when you went to a Michelin-starred restaurant.
Yeah. So
tell me about that. What was the restaurant?
So it was Claridge's when Mark Sargent was cooking there.
Wow.
Mark Sargent and Steve Allen were there. And I'd heard about like Michelin stuff. So obviously I knew Michelin tires because I was a mechanic. So I was just like, what's this guide thing? So, and a few of the chefs I was working with, like, so I managed to get a job at the Marriott Hotel. So like a country club golf course thing. And a couple of the chefs there were talking about Michelin and AA and stuff. Like, and so we went to, I went for lunch and it just blew my mind. Like how the attention to detail, the grandeur of the place, like the cutlery, the like everything was just like stunning, immaculate, like nothing I'd ever experienced before. And I was just like, I get it, Joe. I understand now. Like, this isn't just food. This is like
an experience.
Yeah. And then from then on, yeah, I was just hungry to kind of, well, literally hungry to eat more, drink more, meet people, cook things, travel, like everything, like, and it doesn't stop. I think once you're in this world, it's like, it's never ending.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, was that the moment that inspired you to apply to Michelin restaurants?
Well, yeah, I was working in a hotel, and basically one of the guys there, he was just like, you need to get out of here, kind of thing. Not in those so many words, but he was like, move on. You've learned all you'll learn here. And I was like, oh, I've only been here a year or so. Like, there must be more. And he was like, no. He was like, trust me, get out of here. So what should I do? And I'd never heard of a stage before, but he was like, you can basically take holiday, go and travel around and do a bit of time in a few different styles of restaurant, and pick something that fits you and you like, and go and sort of do a couple of years of training under some really good chefs. So, so I thought, all right. And I wrote loads of letters out and sent my CV out to loads of places. And, a couple got back to me, but not many. I mean, I wrote like 40 or 50 letters. And they must get hundreds. And obviously now seeing it, people get hundreds of applications all the time and they just get missed. So Gordon Ramsay Holdings got back to me and offered me a stage at Petrus in Knightsbridge. And I was just like, yeah, Joe, like I was 20. I was like, why? Like big London, that kind of thing. You know, I just moved up there and just, but when I did a week, actually, I did a week stage. And it was amazing. You know, it was just like, yeah, it was tough. Like, and the hours were long, but you know, I made that choice. And I was, like, basically, I was going to leave at the end of it and do some more stages. And the chef was like, I was like, thank you very much, chef. Like, I really appreciate it. Like, see you later. And he was like, where are you going? And I was like, I'm done. I was just here for a week. And he was like, well, do you not want a job? And I was like, well, I've got a job. I'm just going to do some stages. He was just like, listen, if you want a job, I'll offer you a job now. He was like, go and hand your notice in. You can start next month. This is the date. I was like, okay.
Brilliant. Like,
wow, let's do it. So it all kind of, yeah, so that.
You clearly made an impression.
Yeah, I think, or they were just short staffed. I don't know. I think the bar was very high.
How was it to work with Gordon Ramsay? Because, I mean, that in itself must have been really intense.
Well, no, I mean, this was like 2009, so he wasn't in the kitchen. He used to come in a lot and talk to the staff, and he worked quite closely with the head chef, Sean Burbage, and Mark Askew, who was Gordon's exec for the whole group. So they worked, he was in the contact with them quite a lot, but he was out in America doing lots of filming and things. And obviously, at that point, he had like 5-6 restaurants. He's got hundreds now. But a lot of chefs sort of say that. They're like, I trained under so-and-so. And, do you know what I mean? Like, I didn't. I trained under Sean and Mark Askew. So, yeah, and I did my time. It was good though. It was tough.
Yeah, you were there for the year, right?
Yeah, just over a year. It's I think anyone that's worked in that kind of kitchen. So I went for, I think, so I'm still friends with some of the people, obviously, that we worked with, and one of them was the HR lady, and she's HR lady. I mean, that's a bit. She took care of a lot of the hiring and stuff like that, and I think it was like 80 something chefs in the first 3 months went through. So it was tough to like, and seeing Sean more recently, we met at PX Festival last year, and I was kind of like, it was crazy back then, right? And he was like, yeah, like it was tough. We were super busy, real kind of popular restaurant with a very high standard, and things needed to be perfect or they weren't good enough. So there was a lot of chefs that came and couldn't make it, you know?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's such a high-pressure environment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so was it that experience that inspired you to open your own restaurants?
Not necessarily, no. I think that, obviously, when you start cooking, you always think, I'd like to do that, or you kind of have your own vision about things that are done. And if you just follow the rules, basically, when you're a chef, the boss, the head chef tells you what to do. It's implemented by the sous chefs and you produce it ready for every service. So you're just a cog. You just turn your wheel and make sure everything else stays up. But no, I think it was probably a bit later. So when I left Petrus, I wanted to come home to Kent, basically. I wasn't super happy in London. It was a bit miserable. I missed the big spaces, like the kind of the countryside and stuff. And I didn't realize I would. I didn't realize I would at all, but I did. And you know what? As soon as I felt my time was up, I started looking for another job. And I found Thackeray's in Tunbridge Wells, a restaurant in Kent. Similar standard, Michelin star, 3 rosettes, that kind of thing. So I knew I wasn't kind of dropping to a lower standard of cooking, but just feel a bit more freer. So a guy, Richard Phillips, that owns that restaurant, he at the time owned like 4 or 5 other restaurants in Kent. So, and I ended up working for him for like 7 years, just over about 7 years in total.
Wow.
Working in lots of different restaurants for him. We opened restaurants together, and I was head chef at the new one, the Windmill in Hollingbourne for a while. And I think it was once I had done that, I started to see that I could do it. Like, I think you always have the idea of doing it your way. And it's not until you do it someone else's way for a long time that you realize that you probably don't know enough, then you do know, then you learn, and you have your own vision and you realize, I think you know how to implement it a little bit better. This experience, I suppose. Isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're well known for being a fully self-sustained restaurant. I mean, there must be so much pleasure in knowing your own produce and having control over the way the animals are cared for and raised.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was what I wanted. That's why I didn't just kind of think, right, it's time for me to get my own restaurant now. To be honest, I wanted to work in a restaurant that was like that. I wanted to work somewhere where we cared more about our produce. We cared more about our purpose. We understood where our food came from. We could develop things that are a little bit more unique to the area that we were in. And there wasn't anywhere like that. And I thought, like, well, I'll do it. You know, we'll just do it. We'll just do it for ourselves. And there is, yeah, it's really cool. It's hot soup. Like we say about hard work in some of the top restaurants up in London, like there you always get a day off and you're not checking the lambs at 3:30 in the morning and then still going back into service and stuff like that, or taking the pigs to the abattoir or butchery and charcuterie and weeding and, you know, all of the unfun stuff, like when it's 40 degrees in the polytunnel but you still have to be shoveling barrows of soil around, you know. It's great. It's super rewarding and it's exactly what we wanted to do. So
I mean obviously you're enjoying this period because in normal times you don't really get a day off, do you?
Never because I say get a day off, but I think if you, most maybe chefs or whoever that run their own business, I think you don't want a day off anyway because
it's your own business.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because you're always doing something that's beneficial to you, or it's beneficial to the team, or it's beneficial to the site or whatever. So for me, we do have time off, and that's something that we have learned actually about the lockdown period. So I've reduced the opening hours at the small holding. So we were finding that where we're quite rural and there's obviously no foot flow, we were sometimes doing very low numbers for lunches and stuff. So we're closed Monday, Tuesday. I've added Wednesday to that, so we're also closed Wednesday. And Thursday lunch, Friday lunch. So we're only open like 5 services a week. Which we wanted to kind of just create that sort of supply and demand so that we'd full most services. But also, like, the team still work a full week, but what we do is, our plan is to focus more on having everyone as a team connected with the farm, or going to a vineyard, or doing some research and development, or cooking some dishes, or whatever it might be. So we're not all just only there for service. We're there without any guests. We're there without any service. And we're there just developing personally and as a group. So we can improve and get better.
So what is your concept to creation process when drumming up new recipes? Do you work on that with your team as well?
Yeah, so recipes are different. I mean, so I look at produce. That's the main where we get our inspiration from, is just literally when we're on the farm, what's coming up next? What do you think we could do with it, Joe? Could we? And then using some of the sort of equipment that we've got, whether we're, you know, juicing some carrots and braising some carrots and curing, salting, fermenting, whatever that might be, because we always have lots of everything come at once.
Right.
It kind of challenges you in ways to make sure you look after it and the way that you can use it, but also imparting flavor into stuff. So that's kind of more conceptually, if that makes sense, like of how we're going to work with our produce. We don't necessarily like create recipes. Yeah. And then when we're in the kitchen, do you know, a lot of it's done. So if anything's more specific, I'll literally just write a recipe down on my phone as I'm making it. So it'll be like, if experience, you guess, right, I want to put this many fennel seeds in, but instead of just chucking them in, just weigh them out quickly. And it's 27 grams, for example. So we make a recipe as we're cooking and however it feels and whatever it looks like. But I've always said it to the guys, is like, make sure you understand things that can be different in the recipe. So for example, we used to have a recipe for our butter of how much cream made X amount of butter, but that's not the rules, because when the milk's different, the cream's, when the cows are eating grass, when they're eating hay, when they're further away in the field or closer to the milk parlor, whether they're milked once a day or 3 times a day, it's all different. Whether we get their milk the day from the dairy or the day after, or they were milked at night or the morning, all of those things make a difference between what product we're receiving. So you can't just have like solid recipes unless you work with ingredients that standardized. Say supermarket milk, for example, is produced to a certain like yield and fat quantity, so they get specifics every single time. Whereas we work with more natural produce, so things change a lot, and you've got to understand that as a chef.
Yeah.
And you've got to work with the food rather than just cooking off of a book and then like trying to treat everything the same. Everything's different.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's so different for you because obviously you have all of your own produce. Is there anything that you regularly use that you don't grow yourself?
Not regularly. I mean, we don't grow asparagus. So asparagus season, which we missed this year, which was annoying, but I ate a lot of it. So that we don't grow that. That's from a farm just up the road. A lady called Susie, she grows that for us. Well, okay. And for other people. What do we use that's not from the farm? Do you know, the majority of stuff we're doing, do you know, we're up to like 180, nearly 200 varieties of things throughout the year. So sometimes we buy potatoes with our potato harvest if we use them before the season's out. So some our potatoes really only lasted us till like February this year from harvesting last year. So we use a farm called Morkew Estate in Kent. They grow like 28 different varieties of potatoes. Really, wow. Really cool.
Right.
So predominantly, the only thing that we're not necessarily purchasing, we work with a lot of other farms around. So for example, if we're running low on celeriac, we might phone up a couple of other people and be like, hey, have you got any celeriac? And that's something that we've tried to kind of, the self-sufficiency is something we aspire to, but we're obviously not there yet. We only did 2 years. So, but if it's not from us, it's from one of our friends. It's from someone that we know. But yeah, the majority of things we cook with are from the farm or other farms or from the hedgerows or the woods or the wild food. So
yeah,
seafood we buy in.
It's so impressive. And I mean, I guess this is what led you to be crowned Chef to Watch and by the Good Food Guide. And I mean, it didn't take long to be recognized for that. So how did that feel for you?
Yeah, I was shocked, probably. I hadn't heard of it before. If that, like, I know it sounds really bad because it's an amazing accolade, and we're really happy with it. But like, so I got a phone call like the day before it came out, and they said, oh, we've put you through a Chef to Watch for 2020. I was just, oh, nice. Like, thanks. That's really cool. Yeah. And I could see that she wanted a bit more of a reaction. So I was like, I'm blown away. Like, I didn't know what to say. I was just like, that's like, thank you. Like, I don't know what, if someone tells you, like, we think you're really good, you're like, okay, thanks. Like, it's, I don't know. Like, it wasn't a plan for us to like, to have anything like that. Yeah. And then I realized, I was like, what is it? I looked, Googled it. And, a few of my friends, like other chefs that I knew that had won it before, and I was like, oh my god, I love him, like I really like his food, like that's really cool. And then after that I was a bit more
excited,
proud of it. I thought this is brilliant, like this is really good. So but yeah, as I say, it's, I think in anything you do, we do it because you want to do it and you want it to be the best you can be, and if someone's going to say, you know, keep an eye on that looks like we might be good one day. Like, that's what it is, really. The Chef to Watch means that we've got potential as a restaurant. Obviously, it's a chef, but for me, it's not. It's nothing to do with me. It's to do with what we're doing and the whole team. Because you don't run anything. You can't do anything on your own. And it's about everyone and what we all pull together, sort of similar, like-minded people pulling together for the same kind of goal.
Yeah. And is the idea of having Michelin stars something that you strive towards?
Again, not really. But if you get awarded one, yes, like I'd be blown away. Like, it's, that's an amazing accolade, isn't it? But really? No, we don't talk about it much in the restaurant. We don't like, we're not like, oh, is that Michelin star enough? Like, I don't know. Maybe it's because I've done that kind of stuff. Like, I think you also don't really know what it means. Like, there's certain formulas, I suppose, you could pretend to cook towards, and like having this kind of thing on, does that mean Michelin inspectors like it? And I don't know. I don't know anything about that. So we don't aspire to it. I think it's like anything. If you produce a piece of art, you're not like, oh, I hope this sells for millions of pounds, or I hope it ends up in a gallery. Like, right. Or you make a song, you're not like, I wonder how many Grammys this will get. Like, that's not the purpose for doing it. I think it's a reward, isn't it? Yeah, I think it's just a reward. So, no, but if we got one, I'd be happy.
You wouldn't say no.
I wouldn't say no. I wouldn't say no, but no, it's not. We're a tiny little restaurant in the middle of nowhere, just getting on with our life and cooking for people, trying to make them happy. That's all. That's what's important to us.
Yeah, and you just opened your second restaurant, the Curlew. You literally just opened it in, was it January or February?
February. So we opened on February the 19th, and we closed on March the 19th. So, yeah.
That must have been really painful.
Yeah, it was rubbish. But it was, you know what? It was, so before, rewinding all the way back to before we had the restaurants or anything, when me and my brother, so I run it with my brother Matt, he's always been front of house, I've always been in the kitchen. We both left our jobs and started this pop-up thing called No Fixed Abode Pop-Ups, where we basically just loaded up the back of our cars with plates and portable cooking equipment and turned up into spaces that were closed, like old cafes or gin distilleries. We did a couple of old farm shops at night and things, and basically popped up a restaurant and made a restaurant. So, and we did two concepts. One was like a set menu of like kind of celebrating the produce that's around. And one was like a kind of small plate sharing thing, like everyone just order a load of stuff that hits the table and you just smash it down. So the small holding is the set menu kind of place. And I always said to Matt, I was like, wouldn't it be wicked if we could use like, just do like, not have the control, like necessarily of having a menu that has to kind of balance and flow over multiple courses, but to have something that you can just pick two or three things and a bottle of wine and go and catch up with your friends or your wife or girlfriend or boyfriend, whatever. And there isn't anything like that around here. And we were frustrated because there wasn't anywhere like that for us to go and eat. We had to go up to London.
Right.
And I thought, so basically we got offered, I wasn't looking for another restaurant, but I know the owners of the restaurant, and we got offered it a couple of times, and she was like, please, like, you'll be really good here. Like, this would work really well. And I was like, I don't know. And then something just came about me. It's like, just do it. Like, what are you going to lose? Like, it's 20 minutes from the small holding. It's a beautiful, beautiful restaurant that's had like amazing reputation for a long time. I was just like, this is a great chance for us to cook a different style of food and kind of, and offer a different kind of atmosphere and a different reason to come and share in the produce that we produce. Mm-hmm. Like in a kind of family style, fun, interesting way that's a little bit more unique than anything else that we've got in the area.
How will you be sharing your time between both restaurants?
Just cut in half down the middle. One gets right hand, one doesn't. No. So that's difficult, and that's something that that's I think a challenge in any kind of, in any place. But we're close by, as I say, we've got a wicked team. That's all. What I can say is that I'm lucky to be, I thought like we're lucky to have these people, but I think because of what we do, we attract certain type of people, like-minded people that know it's a lot of graft. They know they're going to have to get their hands dirty, literally. And they know they're going to have to commit for a long period of time, because there's no point in coming to work for us for 6 months or something, because you'll never see any of the, you'll only see a couple of different bits of the farm and the menu. So you need to, and then we're growing every year. So I've got a wicked team in both restaurants that are so strong, that really, they got our back and they really get what we're doing. So I float between, and just spend a lot of, wake up early and go home late. It's basically the rules.
The Curlew, is that opening this weekend as well? So they're both opening on the same day?
No, so Small Home is going to open on the 17th, and right, the Curlew is going to open on the 10th. So again, what that does is it gives us a bit of time just to kind of neaten everything up. And then it gives us time to start back full time at the Curlew before we have the small holding, and then give the small holding a dedication for a couple of weeks, and then can get back into the flow of bouncing between. But and it's great. I love to do that. Yeah, yes, it's not easy, but it's amazing to be able to have that. Like, we've got that chance to go and cook in two different restaurants, two different styles, meet, I was going to say different guests, but actually we normally end up meeting the same guests that come for like a midweek kind of date night at the Curlew, and then they might come out with their friends on the small holding on the Saturday night, and I'll see them in both places, or vice versa.
Right.
So So yeah, a good team and not a lot of sleep is how we balance that.
And you've also opened up a little guest house called May Farm as well. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I can understand people going to both restaurants, because if they're there specifically for you, they'd stay in the May Farm and then they'd both restaurants. But tell me about how the May Farm came about.
So May Farm's a 40 acre farm that's literally just around the corner from the small holding. And a guest. So he came in and he was talking about a property that he's got, and he was like, you could probably do a bit more space. And we were like, yes, please. He said, like, come down, let's have a look. And basically it's a farmland that was pretty disused. Well, for about 20 years, it hasn't been used as a farm. It's got a small cottage on the land. And Gary, the owner, said, look, I really want to do something with it. Like, let's kind of put our heads together. So we did. And we were always looking for something for some accommodation, because we're quite rural and we had so many people saying, where can I stay around you and whatnot. So it'd be quite nice, we thought, to have something that was more connected to our restaurant. So we've refurbished the rooms. It's 3-bedroom barn conversion with a great open kitchen, arga, roll top bath, like real cozy, like lounge area, wood burning fire. Like it's stunning. It's really, really nice. Got a hot tub outside, that kind of thing. It's really, really nice. And then obviously the farm is what we manage for all of our larger things. So sheep are there, pigs are there. We've got a couple of pigs at the small holding as well, mainly just to help the system, like the ecosystem, so we can feed any vegetable trims and stuff to the pigs. And they're good fun to have. The rest of the pigs are at May Farm, along with the majority of our chicks and stuff. And then we're growing up there. Roots and alliums and any of the bigger things that we use, like lots of, that'll just take up a bit too much space down at the small holding. We moved to May Farm. So it's back to a working farm again, really. We've still got a long way to go. We've still got a long way to go with it, but it's quite nice for the guests that stay. So they can go and see the sheep, we can pop and see the chickens, and then wander up to the restaurant and have lunch or dinner, whatever they choose. And we also offer breakfast hampers and kind of room service style stuff down there as well, so you can just go and lock yourself away and chill out. And some guests have done that. They're just like, we're getting out of the city, we don't want to talk to anyone. We just want to have time on your own and wander around. And they've got the whole 40 acres to walk around on, so it's 12-13 acres of ancient woodland and then into grazing fields and obviously where we're growing. So it's a lovely spot.
Beautiful. Have you got bookings for that already once we open up?
Yeah. So we said we didn't know when we were going to be allowed, but we've got bookings from August onwards.
Right.
We're pretty full in August into September.
Amazing.
And then we'll start advertising it. We've pulled it off of our, so normally it's a prompt on the booking. So it'll just say, would you want to stay with us? And if the house is available, then you can stay. But yeah, we were just kind of balancing the restaurant first, and we'll probably introduce that back end of September. Yeah. Ready for any people that want to get away after that into the autumn. The autumn's great down there.
It's a really nice way to grow your business, actually. It's Tom Kerridge in Marlow and Paul Ainsworth in Padstow.
Yeah.
Both of them have done very, very similar things where, you know, it's a culinary destination and the capability of staying there alongside with different type of restaurants. So it's just a really, really nice way of doing it outside of London.
Of course, yeah, and I think that, like, I love to do it when we get time to go and stay and just have a weekend away. Because we're closed on the Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, so Sunday night after service in the summer last year, you know, me and my wife and my daughter, she's only just turned two, so we don't get a lot of time together, so sometimes we'll just jump in the car, drive down to the West Country, get a little Airbnb in a restaurant or stay at a restaurant with rooms, or drive over to France and do the same thing, because it's so cool to do. And I think that is exactly, like, you know, I'd love to do that. So we want to offer that to some of our guests. It's definitely the way forward. It's a bit more work. You've got to kind of switch your hotel mind on and do some like room inspections about the linen and laundry and make sure the towels are still fluffy and all of that stuff. Do you know, it's a new, make sure none of the light bulbs are dusty. Yeah. You've got to kind of, we always do a little check around just before. We got a wicked lady that does all of the housekeeping for us, but we always just like to just make sure the heating's on, make sure it smells nice. Yeah, do you know what I mean? Just make sure it's, so it's a different world to like a restaurant. It's a bit more kind of that hotel route. But
yeah, of course.
It's good fun.
It's brilliant. And so who are the other chefs in the industry that inspire you?
Oh, loads. Well, Tom and Paul for sure. Like I had Hannah Flowers years ago and it blew my mind. So chefs in the industry that inspire me for sure got to be someone like Dan Barber. So I was over in New York last year and we were hanging out in Blue Hill and the food's amazing. His farm's stunning. Like he's been doing what we're doing for like 17 years and he's been doing it a lot better. Like the guy's a genius and I love his thought processes. That's really interesting. Simon Rogan up in Longcloom. I managed to spend a bit of time up there. That was really cool. I love Matt Orlando from Amas in Copenhagen. That's really, I love Copenhagen. Every time I go there, that really kind of gets me going. That makes me it's like a breath of fresh air. There's lots to list. I'd say they're the kind of key guys that I always kind of revert back to for sure.
Yeah, so it's more kind of similar industry sort of people who are doing farming as well.
Yeah, I think when you have that, I think all chefs all have a connection with produce and they always want the best of the best and they don't want to cook with anything else for sure. But I think, and I know you used to notice it, years of stuff just arriving in the back like in the kitchen door and you check off all your veg and you check if it's perfect and stuff. And then if it wasn't, you'd kick off and you'd be like, why is it not? And then the veg supplier would be like, the fennel's like out of season, don't use it, you know. But as a chef you're like, well, I can't because I've already advertised the menu with fennel on it and what else am I supposed to do, you know? If you can't get me the best stuff, I'll find someone that will, kind of thing. So yes, we care about the produce but we don't care how it gets to us. So to have that different mentality of like organizing your grain, so we've got big sort of charts and whiteboards and stuff where we write all of our things on, and we're pretty much locked down now till kind of November is our next big hit of we have lots of things that keep growing throughout the year. And then we have our main kind of seasonal crops and we've got so much available to us. And now we're looking towards like November and artichokes and squashes and pumpkins and stuff like that.
Right.
And Brussels sprouts into December and whatever. So we're always so connected with our produce. And I think chefs that work like that are a little bit different than chef that just order for, because we're ordering from the same supplier, do you know what I mean? Pick the best veg supplier in the country and everyone tries to use him.
Yeah.
But they won't necessarily feel like the vegetables are as important to you as they're like, just get him fennel that looks good. Do you know, it doesn't matter really about the taste. It doesn't matter really about how they've been grown, variety, etc., how far they've travelled, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and that's what makes you chef to watch.
Yeah, watch me doing something.
So what is next? What's next for you? Once we open up and you get all your businesses up and running again, do you think you'd be going down a road of maybe more bigger hotels, that sort of thing?
No, I think, I don't know how everyone else is after the whole lockdown thing, but I think we nearly lost everything. Like including like my house and like I got everything on the line, and I started to realize what's important, and I was just like, do you know, I want to shrink down almost and get back to the purpose. Like we rocketed within literally 2 years. We were like super busy, really full, opened another site, had loads of like, do you know what I mean, there was kind of staff everywhere and the accommodation, and it all got really out of control, I think. It was bigger than we thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
We were just thought I'd potter around, grow some stuff and cook for a few people every now and again. But I think we're definitely going to focus on us as a team, so that's the reason to close on the Wednesday as well, to focus on education, like personal development, as well as like the team development. Try and educate ourselves as much as we can so that we know the thing. I want to sort of tick the boxes of things we don't know. So I was with our cheesemaker the other day making cheese with him, because I haven't actually ever made cheese. Like, we made like quick cheeses, you know, we made feta and ricotta and some mozzarella and stuff. But to actually go, like, it's on a dairy, straight to the cheese guy to make some blue cheese and some Stilton's and some of the creamy camemberts and things like that. Small artisan production, I thought that was great. And so no more restaurants, just make our restaurants better. I think that was I think the thing that as I say, everything we've ever wanted, we had, but I don't think we realised that. We were always looking for the grass is greener and like something new. But as soon as you nearly lose it all,
yeah,
start thinking, actually, I'm happy to still have something I thought I'd lost.
Yeah.
So we just want to make what we're doing better. I think best time in the farm. Yeah. Best time in the farm, best time in ourselves. Slow down a bit. Focus on what's right and what means something. Focus on what's something that's going to benefit us for years, not just like the small stuff. Yeah. No more restaurants.
Fantastic. Well, I love that philosophy, actually. It's really quite pertinent to be able to have. I mean, obviously, this current situation has been a disaster for many, many people. But, you know, I guess the flip side of it, you know, you can take a little bit of positivity and you can, you know, kind of be out looking inwards and see how you can make yourselves better. And you've done exactly just that.
Yeah, massively. Yeah. Well, we're the lucky ones. You know, we've come out the other side of it. Yes, it's been difficult and the online stuff's definitely saved us. But we're the lucky ones. There's people that, well, look at how many of some of the best restaurants in the country have decided to close because it's difficult. It's really hard. No, it's really difficult.
Yeah, it's devastating. So we're just coming to an end now. Thank you so much for your time. But there's one last question that I've got for you. Tell me something about yourself that I couldn't possibly know.
Wow. Something that you couldn't possibly know. I'm actually quite lazy.
Are you?
Yeah. So I'm actually, like, as much as we like chefs and we work so hard, Jesus, sometimes I like nothing more than just sit. You work so hard in your business and your job and you work. Sometimes, like, yeah, I think deep down, I'm actually a super lazy person. I'm just trying to fight. I'm like, I have two voices in my head, like, oh, I'll just go and have a nap in the afternoon. And the other one's just like, get up, you lazy person. Do you know what I mean? Keep going. I'm a constant battle with my proactive self and my lazy self. I think that's probably it.
Right.
That's a secret. No one knows that.
Thank you for sharing it. But I think actually you deserve to be lazy because you do work super hard.
Yeah, but everyone works hard. But I think there's some people that are like machines. Like there's people like Dan Barber, so I mentioned. So he was like, he did this pop-up in Selfridges and he was, a few of our mates worked there with him at Selfridges and he was flying. So he'd do like Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday in Blue Hill, New York, then up to Blue Hill Stone Barns, then fly over to London for the weekend, then fly back ready for Monday. And he'd he used to time his flights so that he could you can arrive right at the time just before lunch. You can do two services a day. And I was just like, what? Like, he deserves to be lazy, but he's not. crazy amount of energy. Some people are just like, you know, I think they're robots.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. It's been absolutely brilliant chatting with you, Will. And guys, if you want to follow Will, he's on Instagram, will.devlin, and I'm at Posh Nosh Gal. Thanks, Will. Take care.
Thank you very much.